We'll get started. All right, well, welcome everybody. It's good to see everybody again. Hopefully everybody's staying well. I'll start with a motion to approve last meeting's minutes.
I'll make a motion to approve the meeting minutes from July 6th.
I'll second that.
All right, all in favor?
Aye.
All right, very good. All right, well, we will get right into the meeting then. We have a couple of people joining us tonight, both Steve Kelly, the president and CEO of Ellenville Regional Hospital, and we have the Social Services Commissioner, Mike Iaposi, who I believe will be joining us at some point during the meeting. So we may as well start with Steve. I'm sure everybody remembers he had joined us our last legislative session. I wanted to provide some additional opportunity to discuss directly with the health committee the programs he had detailed the other night and answer any questions we as a committee may have. So with that said, Steve, the floor is yours.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I do have a PowerPoint that covers a little bit of the ground that we covered before, which I will cover very quickly. And then I'm going to turn it over to Victoria Reed, who is our population health director who runs our rural health network that we have in concert with Ulster County and Institute for Family Health and partner with many others. Our tagline here at Ellenville Regional Hospital is innovating, collaborating, and providing award-winning care. And yesterday, not that long ago, there was a conference in Baltimore, which is the National Conference on Addiction Disorders, and we presented some of our work at that yesterday. So we do a lot of presentations on our work, so we're leaders in this field. So we get that one, share my screen here. That one.
Paul, you can click share screen. Yeah, just click share.
Okay. Yes. Slide from here. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll let the rest of this go away. Your screen sharing stop. All right. You have to forgive my technical incompetence, but I have Victoria here who is certainly a lot better than me. There we go. All right. That's good. Okay, good to go. Okay, so thank you again. I apologize for a couple minutes of disorganization, but that won't last very long. This is a slide from a week and a half ago when we talked about the creation of the Rural Health Network. I want to drive home as much as possible that our work is a partnership that is with Ulster County and others, many others. But as founders, Ulster County has been part of this network right from the beginning. And so I want to just thank you all for that. The vision is really about diet, exercise, stress reduction, and risk reduction. Those are the core principles of population health. We have a whole bunch of different projects that we're working on. We're working on children, adults, seniors, and they all have to do with those four core principles. We look at the problem with deaths in Ulster County. This is from 2017. You can see we had 42. It rose to 56 in 2018. I believe that our work produced results and helped to drive it down by some 41%. COVID has hit, and as you can see, we've had 32 confirmed deaths already this year through June, with 7 deaths that are pending toxic, the toxication, I'm saying this wrong, toxicology results. And if we were to project out what this year could look like, if those 7 turn out to be opioids, then we will be at 64 or 78. I think that's what it says. It's not if you can see it, but so it's, the problem is much worse this year than it has ever been. So while all of the COVID epidemic's been getting all the air in the room, the opioid epidemic has been getting worse and worse. This is also sort of a review of the overdoses. They have been rising. We look at 260 already this year. It just, I want to go back. There it is. 260 already this year, based on the OD mapping that's done in concert with the National Guard. It's really looks like this will be the worst year ever. We talked about this, the MAX project, in our last thing, so I'm not going to spend any time on it really tonight. I really want to be able to focus on the future and the things that we're doing now, which we're going to be focusing on Project Rescue. That's a project that we're working on. We're going to talk about some of the results of that project, the demographics of the people served. We're going to get into this in a great deal of detail, much more so than what we were able to do in the last presentation, which was really a highlight of all the things that we're doing. And this is going to also get into some of our newest things, such as the network engagement tracker, which includes high-risk mitigation teams and peer advocates, and treatment plans, and then what we're doing to refer people and discharge them as they get better. So that's like a high-level overview, and I'm going to turn it over to Victoria Reed, who is responsible for driving this work for us. So, Victoria?
Hello. So like Steve mentioned, I'm the Executive Director of the Rural Health Network here at the hospital. And so I oversee the staff on the Population Health Department who help implement Project Rescue. So I work with all the clinical staff who handle the ED side and coordinate my staff to work with them. So like we talked about last time, Project Rescue, we started as a PDSA and then we were able to receive OASIS funding for it. We are one of 5 hospitals in the state who were funded, so it was a pretty competitive grant, so we were excited to get that. So I'm going to go into the kind of granular detail for 2020 of who we've seen and what our outcomes have been, and then talk more about our follow-up project. So we have a number of methods of contact that people can get in touch with us. So we have the text line, which we showed last time. So far, since we launched that in May, we've had 15 people contact us through the text line. 10 people call us through the Family Advocate line, which is the number the county used to operate and then asked us to pick up when they had a shift in who was handling it. So our population health staff picked up manning that phone, so the phone number could continue to exist. People could continue to get in touch with us. And since we took that over a couple months ago, we have had 10 calls through that line. And then we've had 24 calls straight through our Project Rescue line, which is either calling the emergency department directly or calling our substance use disorder coordinator directly. And her number is on all the flyers and stuff. So almost 50 people, just under 49, have reached out to us by phone, and that could be people who are calling themselves or a loved one. And then we've seen a total of 104 in-person interactions so far in 2020, and this data is up to date as of yesterday. I actually think we have someone in the ED today, so a little bit off, but almost as real-time as possible. 35 of those individuals came in via EMS, 33 were walk-ins. One thing that we noticed early on in 2020 that was really interesting was that more people were presenting post-overdose from driving themselves or a friend or family member driving themselves than we'd ever seen before. Traditionally, people always come to the hospital via EMS after having an overdose. This is the first year we're actually seeing an uptick in people being brought in by family friends because they were revived with naloxone at home. And so that is a good indication that we're actually doing a good job getting naloxone into the community and into the hands of the people who need it the most. And so my team, who deserves a ton of credit for it, they have been burning the midnight oil doing Narcan trainings, virtual Narcan trainings, in-person Narcan trainings, pop-up trainings. I think this year alone they've trained over 600 people already. And that was just the last time I looked at their data. So we're doing a good job getting naloxone out, and that shows it. Two of the individuals came in via the Oracle team, which is the Ulster County Sheriff's team of Wilbur Pretzman and George Hill, led by Chad Story. So we work really closely with them. Four people were transferred from another treatment facility. Eight people came in from a correctional facility. And then one came from a different treatment provider. So all of those people came into our emergency department and were admitted. Of those 104 people we saw in person, 89 listed their visit cause as a use of substance. Four, because they were in the middle of a treatment lapse. So maybe, you know, they couldn't get their buprenorphine or they missed their methadone appointment, something like that. 10 had unrelated medical visits, but they were screened during our during intake and it was flagged as a substance use disorder possibility. So we use a screening called ESPERT so that when people come in, every single person we see in the emergency department is screened for potential substance use. And the idea is that if we can get people who are using substances just at risky levels, like maybe they're having like two beers a week over the drinking limit, if we can intervene there, we could potentially prevent them from developing a substance use disorder in the future. So we trained all of our nurses to be able to do that screening, and we also use MSW interns. So 10 people were flagged through those screenings as potentially having a substance use disorder, and the our coordinator was called in to talk to them. And then one person had a cause listed as other. So the demographics of the 104 people we've seen in person stick pretty closely to what we're seeing statewide and nationally. It's predominantly men. It's predominantly people who are white and not Hispanic. The insurance is pretty fair, pretty broken down across the spectrum, but the data is pretty consistent with what we're seeing. And then age, that's a whole bunch of lines to take in at once. So I have a chart to show it a little easier. So you can see kind of the curve. You have, you know, that 18 to 40 population is where it's really the highest. But then you also see a little bit of a spike again, going back up towards 56 to 60. So the chart to the right is the age distribution for all 104 people. And then the two charts to the left are those breaking down by age or by age and gender. So you can see for females and males, when we break it down that way, that even there, the curve does look kind of similar. Although for women, it seems like the curve is a little bit younger. So of the 104 individuals, these are their primary substances. We do have prescription opiates and heroin broken into two separate categories, but when you combine them, it is 35 individuals, so it's actually the same amount as alcohol. When we originally started Project Rescue, our goal was to focus on opiates, but once we started releasing it, we actually saw a lot of people come in right away for alcohol use and want help getting into alcohol use treatment. So about the same percentage of people we see for an opiate, we also see for alcohol. And then of those 104, 23 had a secondary substance listed. I don't have the data listed here, but a lot of the people who had secondary substances also had a third substance. So, you know, single substance use isn't actually that common. Of the cases that we saw, there were 39 confirmed overdoses and 3 unconfirmed, so potentially 41. 29 were accidental overdoses, 5 were intentional, 3 were suspected, and then 2 were unknown whether it was accidental or intentional. So 29 of them were administered naloxone here with an average milligram of 9.28, which is just over 2 doses. Because each dose is 4 milligrams, so 2 doses would be 8 milligrams. So on average, people are receiving more than 2 doses of Narcan if they're receiving it here in the emergency department. So the way Project Rescue works is when, so that was kind of some demographics of the people we saw so far this year. When they come in, what we do is we call the certified recovery peer advocate from Catholic Charities. They were our partner on the OASIS grant. And so, well, still are because we still have the grant, but we ask the individual, you know, is it okay if we call the peer? Are you willing to talk to them? They can help you get into treatment and stuff. So this year, 9 people agreed to speak with the peer on the phone, 3 spoke with them in the person, and 1 person was a candidate for that to speak with the peer, but refused to do so. We did have a little bit of a lull in being able to reach the peers because Catholic Charities had some staffing changes, which are better now. And in the meantime, we used MSW interns and we have some staff with lived experience that was able to kind of fill in. But so we always made sure that the person who was in the ED was either talking with a social worker, a social work intern, or someone with lived experience to help them out. And then 28 of the patients that we had discharged, and I'm going to show you a slide that shows where our discharges went. 28 of those patients that were discharged to home, the peers made contact within 24 hours, which is actually pretty good results because it can be really hard to stay in contact with the population that we're working with. So at arrival, 8 of the individuals already had a current buprenorphine script, so they were already in some type of treatment. 82 were not, and then 3 had a script, but they had run out of their script, which was most often the reason they were there, because they were out. The CAO scale is the clinical opiate withdrawal scale. So 8 individuals had withdrawal that was significant enough that warranted medical evaluation using the CAOS tool. And that tool is what lets us know whether or not they're a candidate for inducting with buprenorphine. So the average score of those 8 individuals was a 6.7, which out of context probably just seems like a random number if you're not looking at the scale. But 4 of the individuals were candidates based on their score to start buprenorphine, which is also called Suboxone. And that's a partial agonist that it prevents people's withdrawal symptoms. And it also can prevent overdoses, so that's good, but it's a form of treatment. And then 1 of the 3 individuals who had run out of their script, we provided a bridge script. Usually when that happens, the person comes on like a Saturday night and they're out, it's the end of the month and they can't wait until Monday, or their provider isn't able to get them a new script till Monday. So we just carry them through so that they don't go back into withdrawal or turn back to, you know, using the substance because they're in withdrawal. So of the 104 patients, 25 were successfully referred to a treatment agency, which it seems like a low number, but that's 25% almost success rate for referring people to treatment from our ED, which is actually really high if you look at kind of standard practice. So of the other individuals, 53 were discharged to home, so they didn't accept that referral. Within that 53, 6 left against medical advice and 4 eloped, which means that they checked in and they were getting service and they kind of just walked out. 9 were transfers back to corrections. 13 went back to inpatient treatment facilities. So they were already in treatment. They were brought to us usually because they had an overdose at the facility. 4 were transferred to a psychiatric hospital because they had psychiatric symptoms and were not really a psychiatric hospital. So they went to have their psychiatric symptoms handled at the same time as their substance use disorder. And then the one transfer to a crisis center and the one transfer to a hospital-based detox are within those 25 successful referrals. They just went to a different hospital-based center to finish their treatment. So that brings us to our second project, the Network Engagement Tracker. And so this one we're really excited about because it's brand new. We're the only ones doing it. We did a lot of research to see if anyone else does, and we're really cutting edge on this one. So we are building a data tracking system. We try not to use the word tracker because it sounds very big brotherish, but we are building a system that will allow us to generate alerts when individuals might be at risk of having an overdose so that we can intervene before they have the overdose instead of waiting to intervene after they have the overdose. So our partners are Ulster Green and Columbia County. We received funding from the Bureau of Justice Assistance, and we have two main projects. One is the Network Engagement Tracker system, which is the actual data infrastructure, and then the second project is the High Risk Mitigation Team. And that team is going to be deployed based on the data that comes through the Network Engagement Tracker. So the High Risk Mitigation Team has three sub-teams. So it has a Fatality Review Team, an Overdose Prevention Response Team, and an Overdose Response Team. So the Fatality Review Team is made up of county death scene investigators, the coroners, medical examiners, treatment providers, relevant people who we'll look at cases that were fatal and do some death scene investigations, follow-up investigations with the family, use the autopsy and toxicology reports, and really do a study of the individual's life to find out, you know, where did this occur? What was the, you know, the trigger or what happened that set this path? And was there a place where we could have implemented more interventions to prevent this outcome? The second team is the Overdose Prevention Response Team. And so that team is composed of peers and community health advocates and individuals who have lived experience. Their title will vary based on what organization they work for, but for the most part, they'll be in like a care navigation role. And so the NET system will generate an alert to them, and it will say, you know, this client that you are assigned to just left AMA from an inpatient treatment facility. Which means they might have a decreased tolerance and it might be very likely that they're going to use a substance again, or they're being released from incarceration, same thing, decreased tolerance, likely to use. And then those instances, those overdoses are more likely to be fatal as well. So this alert will generate so that that person from the team can contact them right away and connect them with harm reduction supplies, you know, provide them those peer services, try to engage them in treatment and just prevent the overdose from even happening in the first place. And then the third team, the Overdose Response Team, is our Oracle team. So they're going to continue on doing the work that they're doing. They're doing great stuff. They're, you know, responding to scenes of overdoses, accompanying people to the emergency room, helping them get into treatment and things like that. So they'll just continue on what they're doing. But then within the 24 hours following, they'll be coordinating with the peers from the Overdose Prevention Team to connect with that individual to prevent future overdoses. And I'm going through this super quick and it's way more detailed than time justifies, but we're always glad to share more information later. So the bullet points are a list of some of the events that the data system will generate. And the idea is that all of these events foreshadow an increased vulnerability of a fatal overdose. And usually that's because of the decreased tolerance to the substance. So following, you know, completion of treatment or incarceration release or leaving treatment against medical advice or without completing it, losing contact if they go more than 2 weeks without any type of movement on their profile, it'll generate alert that someone needs to, you know, follow up with that person. And that schedule can be adjusted per person. If they missed opiate court dates, things like that, all of those things will generate an alert so the team can reach out to the person. So the idea is that at any point in time when an individual comes in contact with the, like, quote unquote system, whether it's they come in contact with law enforcement or they come in contact with a treatment provider or a social service provider, but anywhere they come in contact with the system and it's known that they're using substances, they can be enrolled into the system so that we can then kind of track them through the treatment course. The spectrum and provide them that support and resources to prevent overdoses from happening. And then Steve mentioned last time that he presented that we're doing a lot of harm reduction, giving out naloxone kits, safe use and safe sex kits, doing a lot of education on medication disposal and preventing medication diversion, because we know a lot of people start with prescriptions before they move on to heroin, and fentanyl test strips to prevent people from using fentanyl or to just use more safely if they do find they have fentanyl. And then our rescue line, which I mentioned before, is a way for people to get us in contact with us. And then I already kind of went through that. We help people find different treatment and recovery resources and get diverted to treatment. And we do have some virtual support groups that we're offering because of COVID.
Okay.
So we are working with law enforcement, which you did mention through some of the slides, that we work really closely with the Oracle team. We're also working closely with the Greene County Sheriff's Department to help them launch their Oracle team. And we're going to be working with Columbia County Sheriff's Department to try and see if they're willing to launch it. Otherwise, we'll be working with the Hudson Police. And we did just start talking with Delaware County about helping the Delhi Police Department kind of replicate this model that we're talking about. So we're trying to spread the model far and wide. That it's the first time it's being done anywhere in the country, so we're really pumped about it and we want to share because we think it's going to have awesome results. But we also work with the sheriff's team at the jail on their medication-assisted treatment within the jail. So if they're discharging someone who, you know, can't get to the treatment provider until Monday and they're being discharged on a Friday and they can't have a gap prescription, then we can help fill that gap and be a bridge clinic. And then we work with the folks from Columbia University and folks at the health department who are employed under the CHASE grant on their different work plans to make sure they're lining up and we're not overlapping, that we're really supporting each other. And this is a list of our opiate work partners, which Steve did read last time he presented, so I won't read it all over again. But we do have a pretty strong list of partners. We are always adding to it, which I think really just makes our work so much more successful and it's more collaborative.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Victoria. And thank you to the committee for allowing us this opportunity to delve deeper into the kind of work that we're doing. When I started out, our tagline is innovating, collaborating, and providing award-winning care. And we are innovating with this new approach that's never been done before. It's also being done across multi-counties, multi-partners. So there's a huge amount of collaboration. And we have been doing a lot with here, obviously we're starting out of Ulster County. This is our home base. And so we really appreciate the opportunity and thank you to Craig Lopez for agreeing to have us, asking us to actually come and speak and be able to go into more detail than what we were able to go into for the full legislature. So we'll answer any questions anyone has.
Sure. Yeah, again, thank you, Steve, for coming and sharing in more detail the programs and, you know, what the hospital is accomplished and continues, you know, to work towards a goal of trying to, you know, solve this really important issue. So with that, I'll open the floor to anybody on the committee who has some questions for you.
I guess that must have been pretty thorough then.
Well, I guess, I lost connection for a little bit. It was part of the presentation. I don't remember if it was when you had presented to the legislature, but your relationship with Gateway.
Well, Gateway is a large not-for-profit here in Ulster County that does a lot of work with people who are mentally ill. And so that does not overlap greatly with our opioid response. But we are working with them on other projects.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I didn't remember if you had touched on your relationship with them or not.
We have a good relationship. This doesn't overlap as much with this initiative.
Right. Okay. Yep. Fair enough. So, is that it? Do we?
Peter had a
have
question.
Anything?
Nothing. Okay. So with the NET program, which I thought was really interesting,
trying to be proactive about preventing.
Yes.
Any way to connect in with families or people who are really close? It all seemed very much system-based, and I wonder if there were any actual personal ways to have flags of, like, somebody who knows somebody and they are know that that person's in danger. Is that information too protected, or I don't know what?
Yeah, so most of the information that we're working with is HIPAA protected data, so that prevents us from releasing it outside, especially because it falls behind the 42 CFR rules, so it's like an extra level. So we have had to be really crafty with all of our like BAAs and our data sharing agreements and consents and stuff. We have been packing what we're calling leave behind bags. So they're bags that are full of harm reduction, treatment resources, and Narcan kits, so that when the sheriff's guys are on scene of an overdose, they can actually leave those bags behind with family members. And then we're in the process of ordering more like magnets and stuff to get more of the family advocate line and the text line out. But I think family members are reaching out to Tanya, she's our substance use disorder coordinator, quite a bit to get that information, especially when we're doing Narcan. We've been doing pop-up Narcan training, so we actually just did one in the gazebo Friday, right in the middle of town. It was in the paper. And so when we're doing those, like, people will just come up to us and just start asking questions of, like, you know, what can I do? How can I help? Who do I call? And we try to do a lot of education on harm reduction. So if somebody is using a substance, there's an actual app that you can use that you set like a timer. And then after you use, the timer will go off and you have to hit the button. And if you don't hit the button, it means you probably had an overdose, and it will automatically call a friend or a family member or 911. So we try to do education on stuff like that to introduce harm reduction so that we can kind of work, not have to deal with all the HIPAA stuff, but still get people connected, because we know that social isolation is what's driving the drastic increase during COVID. And so connecting people to having their families involved in their care is really important.
Thank you.
Now, Steve, at what point do you think you'll have actual numbers, like hard numbers of how many overdose deaths are directly or indirectly related to the COVID outbreak, whether it's from isolation type issues or, you know, less access? I know it'll probably be some time before, there's people actually look on the connection between, potentially numerous possibilities. But I figured it'll be some time now.
Yes, I think that I think there's a very strong correlation, and it'll be a while before there'll be enough data and reliable data that we'll be able to share that. But as you can see, we have a lot of data on a program we just started. So, and the network tracker really is about capturing people with a net that are falling through the cracks. That's kind of where the name came from. And that is really being launched in September. So this is as current as it gets. These are programs that are being developed as we speak and being launched as we speak. So you are right on the cutting edge of, nobody's ever done this before. Trying to go from an agenda where we're trying to revive people, which is what we do with Narcan, and then treat them after they have overdosed. We're at the point really preventing overdoses for people at high risk. That is really pretty remarkable stuff. So we're very proud of this work that we're doing together with Ulster County and so many other partners. So.
Very good. Anything else, anyone? I'm looking through here.
I don't see anybody. Something, Craig? I know I'm not on the committee. Can I just ask one quick question? The deaths that you have, Steve, are quite a bit higher than our stats, almost seeming like double. It seems like you're almost counting both the confirmed and the pending, because I thought that we were higher, like we were closer to 38 for 2020, which is still the same as we had all of 2019, but I'm not sure where you're getting 78.
There's a couple of pieces. We were at 32 that are confirmed, which I think is your numbers.
Correct.
For 2020. There are 7 that are pending. So that would bring us to 39, which I think is not that much different than the number.
No, that's our number is 39.
Yeah, well, that's the number. And then if that's only through June, so if you double that.
Got it. So you're saying for the year 78. Okay, I misunderstood that. I thought
you were. Oh, that's a projection. That's not an actual.
Projection.
It's not.
I hear you. Okay.
Halfway through the year, if you double it, That's about the projection.
I misunderstood that piece. I thought you were saying there was 78 to date.
No, but we're on track to have 78. Pretty big number. We're much worse than we've ever had before. So we're just trying to draw the magnitude that the issue hasn't gone away. It's gotten a lot worse since COVID has hit. And so I think the work that we're doing now is even more important than it would have been otherwise, because instead of things trending down, up again.
All right. Very good. Anything else? Anyone else? All right. Very good. Well, thanks again.
Thank you very much. We appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you. All righty. Well, we will move on. We will keep going. And we also have with us tonight the Commissioner of Social Services, Mike Iaposi. I think the original idea of this invite was we had some committee members that had inquired about the process of state pass-through vendor contracts and how they work, how the vendors are chosen, and how much control, if any, do we have as a county regarding the process. So if I had missed anything on there, anyone's willing, you're welcome to chime in. So with that said, Commissioner Iaposi.
Good evening, Craig, and thanks for the invitation to join the meeting this evening. Appreciate that. And generally, following up, I believe, on the last committee meeting, I did receive some of the questions that were posed, and I think it was in connection with pass-through funding that we have from OCFS or a behavioral therapist position. So I did receive an email from Eve about that and answer those questions. Generally speaking, it's going to depend on a lot of variables. It's going to depend on the allocation, the time frame, and the services. And we're going to basically evaluate those three variables in accordance with what our procurement requirements are going to be. So in that particular example, we basically had an amount of money for a specific service from OCFS that was designated for a time frame and ended up, as a result of the specific services, deciding to advertise for an individual who would have the qualifications. So we received resumes from interested individuals and we ended up conducting interviews and we arrived at selecting an individual who presented with the skill set and qualifications to be able to provide the services. And then subsequently, as time evolved, with that particular funding stream, it started in 2019. And we ended up hiring the individual around June of 2019. So I think at your last meeting, there was a resolution proposed to extend that contract. And we basically set forth terms and conditions in the contract for services that are to be provided at an hourly rate. And we essentially monitor the contract in terms of making sure that the services are being provided. I'm happy to share the Q&A that I had with Eve in connection with that particular contract. I think Lynn Archer was also another legislature that was on that, and Mark participated in that. I can also talk about some other programs that we have, which are similar to the degree that, you know, one of them that I think is going to be coming up is going to be a resolution to approve accepting funding from OTDA for our Code Blue plan. And, you know, there again, it's an evaluation that we undertake to determine what are the services that we're supposed to be utilizing that funding for, how can we best provide them, and who can we arrive at identifying as a service provider that's going to be able to provide those services. And because in these activities, it's 100% funding, we really want to be doing a thorough and comprehensive job and making sure that we're being able to capitalize on the full allocation and that we're also able to provide all of the services. For the Code Blue plan, an interesting dynamic is that we actually have to submit a plan to OTDA setting forth what services we're going to provide, and they'll essentially then approve the services that we contemplate. I'm going to pick that up later. It's one of our deputy commissioners, but I'll catch up with that person later. But getting back to the Code Blue allocation, that's one where we always want to be, again, really comprehensive and thorough because it's 100% funding. And we want to make sure that we're covering all of the services that we're supposed to be providing there. So those are just a couple of the examples of how we arrive at it. Again, we're very diligent about making sure that we comply with the county's procurement requirements in terms of amounts and professional services, and if we do have to RFP. So in that regard, again, you know, we're just always looking at these programs as programs that are ones that we're responsible for administering, and we want to make sure, which I think the entire county is really diligent about, making sure that we're able to claim the full allocations that have been awarded to us. I guess I would just say with any specific program, I'm happy, you know, through Mark to provide you with details. We have a couple of resolution. I think we have one resolution that's for a pass through. It's an award from a philanthropic foundation, but that's, you know, not dissimilar, but to the degree that, you know, we're seeking to obtain permission to be able to receive funding again for specific purposes from Redlich Horowitz, which is a foundation that supports foster children and foster families. And particularly during the COVID crisis, they made awards to county departments of social services for funding to help enhance our ability to provide specific kinds of services during the crisis. So I know that's one of the resolutions that's, I think, on tonight's agenda. So, you know, for instance, speaking to that, that's a second allocation that we're receiving from Redlich Horowitz. It's for, I think, $13,680, and we're looking to allocate that towards making arrangements to enhance our home finder capability so that we can expedite certifying foster families. And the first allocation, which was earlier this year, was for a larger amount of money. I think it was around $20,000. And with that, we were equipping our foster family household with tablets and internet service to facilitate visitations and meetings that they needed to participate in as a result of the limitations that have been placed on all of us in terms of in-person meetings. So that's just another example of us obtaining funding that we seek permission to be able to receive through resolution, and that we then allocate by making arrangements with either service providers or individuals pursuant to contracts.
Pete.
So if I'm remembering the issues correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the two things that we were wondering were, does the funder have any say in who you choose as provider, or is that completely through your office? And then the second one, I think, actually just had to do with the monetary amount for one staffing individual. I think it was 140 grand for one social service person. Did I get those both right? I think those were the concerns.
Yeah, I think those were questions, Peter, that were set forth. The funding entity normally does not exercise any sort of specific control over how we arrive at utilizing the funds. We obviously have to demonstrate to them that we're arriving at an arrangement that is specifically for the purpose of the underlying allocation or grant. So that's why we have some flexibility there in terms of whether or not we might, you know, utilize the funding in-house. What we might do is a service provider, or we might contract with an individual. The allocation amounts can vary. For the one you're talking about, the full allocation was for $140,000, so that's why it's set forth in the resolution for $140,000. With that one, we may probably not end up expending that full amount if the program is not continued into 2021. What we'll do is we'll monitor the invoices that we receive from the individual that we contract for. I think the concern that Eve identified was, would the person end up submitting invoices to be able to essentially capitalize on receiving the full amount? And that's not going to be arrived at because we're going to be monitoring the contract and the invoices, but we do have to set forth the full amount of the allocation because that's what OCFS has awarded to us. It does remain to be seen whether or not they're going to continue that through 2021. That's a little bit different from the Code Blue allocation. Code Blue is going to be something that we have an expectation of 100% reimbursement for, but what that will depend upon is how much we request in our plan, and then they have to approve the plan that we request. So depending on what we project our expenditures to be, for instance, in our Code Blue plan, we operate a warming center. So we might project that we're going to have X number of activations at a cost per activation. For the Code Blue season 2018 to 2019 in our warming center, we had about 175 activations. So for our 19-20 plan, we projected about 170. We ended up with about 150. So our plan requested an amount that was more than we ended up having to use, but we ended up receiving an allocation for more, but we're only going to claim for what we used. So I hope that made sense.
That makes total sense. Just a quick follow-up. So you said normally the funder is not involved. What are the circumstances where a funder would be involved in the picking of who the individual would be?
Mike, okay, well, Mike, can you explain a subrecipient of a grant? Because we see that a lot with family or other places where the granting source, there's a subrecipient already in the grant, right?
A good example of that was actually something that Steve was talking about with the funding for opioid outreach, where OASAS, as the state entity that was granting the funding, they chose Catholic Charities of Orange, Ulster, and Sullivan to be the service provider. So Orange, Ulster, and Sullivan, Catholic Charities of Orange, Ulster, and Sullivan became the service provider that had to partner with other entities in those particular counties. So that's where they might select a service provider who then will engage in a collaborative fashion to receive referrals and provide services with other entities in the county. We have something that's on our radar, which is a grant that Ulster County is going to be receiving through the Federal CARES Act. It's called an Emergency Solutions Grant. And OTDA will be administering that to all the counties. What they have required is that the counties participate in a collaboration that will involve DSS, Department of Health, Emergency Operations, and our County Continuum of Care. And what they're indicating there is that we will arrive at nominating a candidate to be the lead agency, which would be a service provider. And then we, as county departments, we will all collaborate with that lead agency to make sure that this emergency solutions grant, which is for benefits to go to persons that are facing housing and food insecurity because of COVID. But in that collaboration, their OTDA is basically going to make the ultimate choice, Pete, of who is going to be the provider. So it can really vary. It can just depend upon what the nature and the circumstances are of the allocation for the specific kind of activity. So that will be one where the money's not going to be funneling through DSS or DOH or emergency operations, but will be involved in the process. But OTDA is ultimately going to select who the lead agency will be.
Okay. I just wanted to, you understand the concern, right? That it could look like there's a funding agency that has a particular entity or person or something that they're pushing forward, and then it's being passed through so that there's no control on this side, but basically the funder is saying, this is who I want. You know, I come at this from a nonprofit side, and you know, that can happen in nonprofits when you've got a grantor who's like, well, my niece is a whatever, you know, I'll give you $100,000 and my niece now gets the job. I'm not saying that's what happened, but I think that was an example of what the concern was.
Certainly, no, I can understand that. And as I said before, we're very diligent in making sure that we follow all of the county's procurement requirements. And with regard to that behavioral therapist grant, we specifically advertised that to make sure that we did arrive at an outcome where we, you know, received resumes from qualified individuals, conducted interviews. So the entire process is transparent. And, you know, that is something that clearly we don't want to arrive at having someone selected. The emergency solutions grant that I just described to you is also being undertaken in a fashion that will, you know, arrive at an outcome where a lead agency is selected, but all of these other collaborative parties will have participated in that process. And ultimately, the application that gets submitted to OTDA will have to be reviewed and approved by them to select this lead agency.
Got it. Thank you so much for clarifying that.
You're welcome. And again, as I said, you know, it's on a program, by allocation, by grant basis. And we're always available to provide detailed information about the nature of an allocation program or grant and how we selected a service provider or contracted with an individual to administer that.
And I would assume, say, for an example, if these monies were coming out of the state, these pass-through dollars. They also have an RFP type process that the county does, which would, I would hope, prevent, you know, awarding these contracts, you know, based on potentially who you know or who you are or something along those lines. So,
yeah, I think, Craig, that's certainly, you know, the process seems to be arrived at taking that into consideration. And, you know, we certainly, also, I think an important dynamic, especially again with this emergency solutions grant, giving the county some flexibility and discretion with its departments who are involved in seeing what our COVID-related needs are, hopefully means that the dollars get allocated to the needs we have, which could be very different from another county, depending on the nature of what they're experiencing. And, you know, we're a large, predominantly rural county with a lot of unique needs, but obviously our proximity to the Hudson Valley region and New York City, you know, also creates other kinds of circumstances that we often need to take into consideration. So I think they try to incorporate some flexibility and discretion with the right amount of oversight and requirements. And it's just trying to strike that balance.
Right. Very good. Anything else? Well, great. Thanks, Mike. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Okay. Good to see everyone. I hope you're all safe and well.
Hey, Mike, why don't you stick around just because you have two resolutions in case there's questions?
I can stay on board.
Okay. All right. Well, then we'll jump into resolutions then. We will start with, let's start with 268. And that's amending the 2020 budget to accept an allocation of funds with Horowitz Foundation to support home finding activities within the foster care program. Move for discussion.
I'll move that.
I'll second.
Wait a second. All right. And to speak what Mike had touched on, that the funds will be used exclusively, right, to recruit, train, certify, recertify potential adoptive parents. Yeah. As part of the county foster program.
Yes, Craig, that's what our plans are with that.
Okay. Are there any other questions on that? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, we will move on. The next one is what, 294? Is that your other contract, I believe?
Yes.
Approving the execution of contract amendment in excess of $50,000 with Liberty Resources. This is to extend the term for PINSCARE management services. Move for discussion.
I'll move that.
We get a second?
A second.
Okay, a discussion? Like, if you want to give a brief background exactly what this resolution will be doing moving forward, or if anybody has questions.
This is 294?
It's 294. Mm-hmm.
So this is through Liberty Resources, and the purpose of the position is a PINS case manager. PINS cases are persons in need of supervision. The case manager is a master's level social worker who has a caseload of between 15 to 20 youth at a time, and basically referrals are received for crisis intervention and exploring the specific needs, educational, vocational, social, mental health related, and trying to make sure that these youth and their families are linked to services that support them successfully completing whatever the program is that they arrived at in terms of the diversion that they're in. So we receive referrals from obviously internally DSS, from family court, and from probation. And, you know, our goals here with the PINS case manager is to obviously continue to divert youth out of detention or any further criminal or delinquent activities. So in consideration of the implementation of Raise the Age, that population has also grown now to include 16 and 17 year olds. We basically continue to experience that we're seeing enough referrals to put this resolution before you. We're requesting that we continue to support the position. It's a one-year extension in the amount of $69,000. Based on where we get the referrals and what specific programs the youth are in, if they're in foster care, if they're in prevention, if they're in probation, we usually capture anywhere between 55 to 70% reimbursement. So with some of the youth, it's on a youth by youth basis. So I just, and that's different from pass-through. This is not a pass-through situation. This is the contribution that we would get after we do our claiming to OCFS based on the specific services that the youth receive who are referred to the PINS case manager. So your local share here will probably end up being about somewhere between 30 and 35%.
Is there any kind of documentation on the success of programs like this?
Yes, we can provide documentation from the PINS case manager. Our coordinated children's services enjoys a very high percentage of keeping youth from having to go into placements, Peter. So I can provide some statistics for the last cycle and forward those on to you if you want to see that.
It's great. I'm a big believer in preventative, so I think that this is wonderful. I was just curious to see how the program.
Sure. No, absolutely.
All right, anything else? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Very good. All righty, well, we will move on to resolution 294. That's approving the execution of the contract amendment in excess of $50,000 with Liberty Resources. Oh wait, no, I'm sorry. That's the one we just did, this is 295. It's approving the execution of a contract next $50,000 with Health Research providing funding to increase capacity for COVID-19 case investigations, contact tracing. So move for discussion.
I'll move it.
Sorry. You keep beating me, Peter.
So this is CARES Act funding that will be used for primarily staffing. It is about $400,000. It's basically federal funding that's going through Health Research Inc. to us. So it's the opposite of a pass-through. It's for 2 years, between basically July 1st, 2020 till I think June 30th, 2022. If we accept this funding, we'll likely hire potentially 3 additional public health nurses. Their intent here is to use the vast majority of it for staffing, and we cannot supplant. So that means if we put any of our regular public health nurses into this grant, we have to backfill that position. So this is the kind of scenario where we would look to sunset these positions once this 2-year grant goes away, assuming that COVID will then be done. They want quicker case investigations to happen, and so that's where the funding is coming from.
I have a question. Can I just ask?
Yeah, just go for it.
All right, thank you. So the positions, I mean, are there any positions that have hit either the sunset or the end of a grant that we could be supplementing and keeping, you know, nursing staff on with our health department? Or, I mean, how do we, and it also—
We don't have any health department nurses that we are, that are going to lose a position because it's sunsetting. In fact, you know, we have a few that are retiring, but we don't have any that can go into this position. And I think it would be hard. I think they would look at that as supplanting. They're really not looking at us continuing our normal operations and still receiving this money. They're looking for us to supplement our normal operations. And ideally we would take 3 individuals and they would be our COVID kind of public health nurses until we hit another, like a second wave. When we hit a second wave, it'll be all hands on deck. But our patient services nurses have really just focused on COVID, and there's other work that they do year round with STD clinics and TB clinics and other things that they're just not able to get to right now. So this will help with that.
And the other million, the first 477,000 was personnel, but there was another million in there. Is that for programming or?
It is actually a placeholder. We are not authorized to spend the other million. I know. So it's literally the $400,000 for 477. The 1 million they wanted to put in there, if there's more, you know, CARES 2.0, then this will easily get the money to flow through us, but we're only authorized to spend the first 477 at this point.
So is that money that we get and spend, or is it money that we spend and then submit to get reimbursed?
It's reimbursable, but it's I think out of the 477, I think 380 something is available like right away. So we could just spend it and get reimbursed automatically. And then the other will come behind. And in reality, we'd be hiring these. We're not going to be able to spend it like that anyway. This will cover salary and benefits for roughly 3 individuals.
Okay, Craig. Oh, we lost him.
Froze up.
We lost Craig. Who's second in command, Peter?
So, any other questions? If there's no questions, move to call to a vote.
Aye.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. Any abstentions? No.
Yeah. I needed three, so I needed all three of you right there.
You got it.
And one more, Pete. 266.
Can I move it even though I'm a sponsor?
Yep, 266. Okay. Laura, do you want to talk about this?
Yes. And actually, Al Bruno and Mary Woro, I don't know if you got my email, yes. Nettie, to be sponsors as well. This is, I had attached some links for other municipalities and or states that are already doing this. And what it is many public areas, municipalities, the county building have automatic defibrillator equipment there. And it's a no-brainer that we have at this point in the world. The Narcan or naloxone stations next to those as well for quick and easy access. You know, the numbers, as you could see from Steve's presentation earlier, are only going up. And, you know, the immediate response is saving lives. Fortunately, you know, the deaths are going down, even though it appears that the administering of the Narcan is going up. That is basically it in a nutshell. It did not include where most of the aid, and this is backwards too. It says automatic defibrillator equipment, but then it says AED equipment. We may have to fix that title. But they're also in senior residents. That's questionable. It's my understanding that they do have overdoses in senior living. However, that's more created by the medical profession in misprescribing the medication. And I don't know if a nursing home would want a Narcan unit. I mean, I did not put that in. But if it is the will of this committee to add in a paragraph that it does include nursing homes, I'd be fine with that.
I'm not actually seeing the law here. I'm just seeing in our packet the resolution for the public hearing. Am I missing something?
Yeah, there should be a law attached.
It's not there.
I just see it go straight from
Susan. It's not. The only resolution came across as the public hearing.
Number 11, resolution 11.
So it didn't include the law was only one page. And then there was a supplemental page with articles and attachments to that.
Let's see if I can include you.
Okay. Thank you, Nadi.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So the AED locations, are those compulsory right now?
Those are, yes. It's a state requirement that public areas, including events, have AED equipment there, or ADE. I think it's AED.
AED. So there's, so the law here, local law 11, would
put in the
there would be no situation where someone was now required, like if someone had an AED voluntarily in a location and they weren't compelled to do so, but they did anyway,
they wouldn't
be covered by this, right? They wouldn't then now be compelled to put naloxone next to it, would they?
Correct. That is correct. They would not be required to. It would only be under, in the locations as required under the New York State law, under the Department of Health. And it looks like that's law, purpose and policy, chapter 552. I can send you that. Unless, Nettie, do you have it? Because laws were quoted in the backup documentation.
I'm sorry. I was sending you the local law. I put it in the OneDrive. I'm sorry. What was the question?
Oh, you did get it? Okay.
I see it in here now. Yeah.
Okay.
You got it? Okay.
It's in the OneDrive. So if you look at the committee packet now for this meeting, you'll see it in there. Thank you, Nettie.
You're welcome. I apologize. It should have been in there.
Thank you.
Question. Costs. Who picks up the costs for all this?
The cost would be the owner of the public area.
And what are the costs?
That, I'm sorry, I don't know. I've always only participated in the free programs.
So a restaurant, is a restaurant, does a restaurant have to have?
No. No, it's municipal buildings, it's venues, you know, such as swimming areas. It's not restaurants, you know, it's not a hotel. Those are not included.
All right. I'm just thinking this is a tough time for any business to have extra costs. I believe in this, but I also think that we should find out what the costs are and you know, is there any funding for it somewhere? Is there some way that there could be some assistance to help get this put in?
Which does it cost?
Yeah, I think the costs are an important aspect of this too. Because, you know, to speak to Peter's point is that, yeah, it's kind of a tough time for another government mandate saying that this has to be purchased. And, you know, I'm interested to know what the actual hard costs are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting $130 to $140 for two doses, but, and then this one says it's $100. I mean, I guess then you go back to what is the cost of a life, you know, or putting somebody on, especially if they're on Medicaid, putting them on into ICU for weeks because they've done that much damage to themselves. So, you know, I think that's the easier access. I mean, I happen to have doses of Narcan, but I don't know how many other people do. And even our legislator, Heidi Hain, happened to be outside of a CVS and ran inside and got two doses for two individuals who had OD'd outside in the parking lot. So,
and who would be responsible for administering? Would it be?
It would be under the same laws as the AED equipment. So you're covered under the Good Samaritan law. And it would be administered by, you know, the individuals who had access to the AED or Narcan.
Right, and so they'd require training in order to administer it.
Well, you don't with the AED; it talks to you. So.
Right, but Narcan doesn't talk to you. So.
It doesn't, but it's a simple nasal, you know.
Right, but still, you know it. There's a process here. I did two of these trainings, and mm-hmm. You have to. There's a process to. Up, am I still there? Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if I lost connection. You have to put it together. You have to know, how to administer it. Like that. Yeah, I think you would need some training. Craig, but it's just anybody was able to do
me,
it.
Craig, I'm sorry, Craig. It's Mary. Can I say something?
Yeah. Sure.
Oh, the original trainings that I took did involve putting pieces together, but the new doses are like in kind of like a nose spray. Okay. So it's just like, you know, the Efferine stuff that you just squeeze it. So you're right, before you really definitely did need some type of training because it was very intimidating getting the pieces together, not breaking the vial of glass, which I know someone that happened to. But it's much user friendly at this point. It's almost very.
You don't really need any training.
No, understood. But there is some level of instruction that goes into administering it. So you know, and not only if somebody takes the course, you get a free dose of it. Right? From the courses that I've given, you know, you end up getting one or two kits and. Potentially, if that was part of the mandate, if they have to have Narcan, perhaps it would be mandatory that somebody takes the course and potentially gets a free dose rather than actually, you know, putting out the $130 to whatever it may cost. But I think that, you know, some level of instruction would be important in order for somebody to comfortably administer this when and if that situation arises.
Sorry, Craig, it's Mary again. I think that that's true, like in your normal thing, but I think that if you're like at a public event and something like this happens, I try to carry one in my purse, but I keep having to give them to people that are using them. It would give somebody who is trained access to one that they might not have with them available.
Okay. And that's assuming somebody's around.
And also, I imagine if you didn't know how to use it, you wouldn't even try to use it. We hope that people would.
Direction on the box that's pretty simple to follow.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I get an understanding of what the it's saying that it will be a dispensary or what is it that you're seeing? Is it like a medical cabinet? Okay.
Yeah.
So they're not just purchasing the dose; they're purchasing some sort of a cabinet and the installation of it. So we did
the AED equipment.
Because at this point now we could be talking $500 or $600 to purchase the thing, have somebody come in and install. So I'd like to see that. The other thing that I'm curious about is, once this takes place, is there some sort of a time frame that people have to comply? And if they don't comply, what's the repercussions?
Okay. So are you going to get back to me with some recommendations then, and we can discuss this again next month?
Sure. You know, I think that there's enough questions. Look, I don't think I've ever voted against a public hearing. You know, I think it's our job to allow the public to weigh in. And I know that there are a number of answers that we can get in the interim, the lead up to a public hearing. But, you know, at the same time, I think it's important to know what hard costs are. To Pete's point is that, it could be quite expensive if you have to not just buy the equipment, but have it installed. And yeah, I just think that there are a number of questions that, you know, potentially we can get answered to if we, if you are willing to hold off on it, you know. But if not, then, you know, again, I don't have an issue with a public hearing if we get the answers to the questions
that
we have in the interim. So,
and I have to say, I feel like if we're asking these questions right off the bat, the public hearing is going to bring all these questions out. Let's try and get it sorted before we actually then bring it to the public.
Fair enough. As long as I get input, I'll go in and I'll get some more research done, but you know, it's you can't really put a value on a life. And it's at the same location. In fact, I just tried to send you a really nice single flyer that had all the information on it, but I sent it to Public Works instead of Public Health. But the AED equipment was significantly more. That was probably closer to between $800 and $1,200 a unit. So, you know, to put in
get this wrapped up tightly so that once it goes to a public hearing, it just goes really smoothly through and then we can just pass it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing, because you don't want to have a public hearing and then you have to make significant changes to the point where you need another public hearing. So, and that's mm-hmm. often the problem. If you can get these issues addressed prior to, and we don't have to go through the process again, I think it would be probably the best way to go.
I'll sign on to this as a co-sponsor if we can get it cleaned up that way.
That would be nice. Thank you. Okay.
And for what it's worth, the administration is supportive, and for sure we can actually roll this out to our county buildings pretty quickly. In fact, Pat Carroll, the security guard, I think has put these boxes in most of the AED cabinets that are in the county office building. And to the extent that we could combine and put the Narcan in the same cabinet, it would be helpful. So I don't know if that would be a tweak that could be made. But if this just dealt with county buildings, we'd be able to go through pretty quickly.
Okay.
Laura, I sent it to the Public Health Committee.
Okay, good. Because I sent it to Public Works. So did you, you just forward it for me? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Everybody's got the email.
Yeah, and my trigger finger went too quick. Okay.
I know how that is.
All right. So Mark, thank you. That's a really good point. It doesn't necessarily have to go into a special cabinet, but I will get the prices. We'll get an effective date. I believe it said effective immediately, but we can always put January 1st on there. And I will do you one more. I will do some funding.
And also repercussions for noncompliance.
Okay.
Right. Okay. All right. Very good. Well, then we'll take no action. And and then we'll discuss it next month.
Thank you.
Sounds good. Okay. All right. Very good. Well, is there anything else? Is there any old business, new business, anything somebody wants to bring before the committee? All right. Hearing nothing. A motion to adjourn.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
Second. All in favor?
Aye. Bye, guys.
All right. Very good. Bye.